Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forces. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin. We're in the observation room of the University of Ottawa Law School's courtroom. And today, Stephanie, what are we talking about?
Well, today we're going to talk a bit about this breaking story that we have about Canada basically declaring four diplomats, using scare quotes, diplomats, probably intelligence officers, engaged in some kind of threat-related activity. They've been declared persona non grata as a part of kind of a coordinated campaign with other Western countries in response to the chemical weapons attack that we've already discussed. As well, we're going to talk about Cambridge Analytica because everyone else is, and I think we need to catch up.
Yeah, Cambridge Analytica. Although we're gonna talk a little bit about the background, and we're gonna invite in Teresa Scazza, who is a colleague of mine, a specialist in privacy law, and I had a chance to talk to her about some of the issues surrounding Cambridge Analytica and privacy law, and we're gonna riff from her comments into a conversation about this recurring discussion about whether CSE and CISA should have access to publicly available information in the course of their enhanced powers under C-59, because these two things have been connected in the public mind, at least in some commentary. And then we're going to actually try to do a double header this week, and so we'll post a second podcast, ideally at the end of the week, your Easter special, on some of the issues around national security and investment, which have been much in the news, and we'll probably squeeze in some conversation about trade law, since national security seems to be part of aluminum and steel tariffs these days.
You know me, I love some trade law.
Right.
Who doesn't?
Chocolate and trade law.
Chocolate and trade law. They go together. Chocolate and trade law.
Okay, but before we launch into our topics du jour, let's also just bring people up to date. Of course, this past week, the accused shooter in the Quebec City mosque shootings from last year pled not guilty in terms of the charges of murder and attempted murder that have been brought against him. And that trial is expected to commence in April. So once the trial record is fully developed, we may have a better sense as to the details of that tragic event.
Can I just say, I think the interesting thing is here is that, you know, one of the things we talked about last fall was how that individual was not charged with terrorism offenses. Right. And we've seen that come up again in relation to the very sad story in the Florida shooting that, you know, this is someone who probably seemed to at least be sympathetic to very extreme, very, very far right views, potentially some white nationalism as well. And this individual hasn't been charged with any kind of terrorism, nor has the bomber that was in Texas in the last week.
Or the Edmonton case.
Right.
But the rationale, because this has come up again, and I spent some time again speaking to some members of the media about this, is that our terrorism law is geared towards preemptive crime enforcement or law enforcement. In other words, the crimes really reach conduct that's preparatory to actual acts of violence. And once the acts of violence occur, conventional crimes are more readily available and require that the prosecutors prove fewer things. And so that's why, in relation to everyone's in prison right now for a terrorism offense, they were all preempted. In other words, they never got to the boom or bang stage. And so what happens as soon as you get an actual act of kinetic violence, the incentive for the prosecutor to seek terrorism charges, and even the question as to whether any are applicable in a circumstance when you have the so-called lone wolf or lone actor, becomes a ripe issue. And in both the Quebec City and Edmonton cases, the prosecutors have obviously decided that there's no advantage from a legal perspective in seeking terrorism charges. Politically, it's awkward because it creates the perception that terrorism is one of these crimes that's connected solely to ISIS or Al-Qaeda-inspired acts of violence, or at least acts preparatory to violence, and that creates a negative discourse on issues of terrorism. But legally, it's a very understandable practice on the part of prosecutors.
Yeah, it reminded me of those issues and the discussion that we had. And, you know, I think, you know, it's probably okay for political leaders to describe it as terrorism so long as it doesn't, I guess, interfere with the trial. But I do think this is a problematic thing we have in our discourse about terrorism generally.
Right. Okay, so let's move on and talk a little bit about developments in the Salisbury case. And we're not going to try to catch people up on all the moving parts in this saga, because there are quite a few now. But the one that, of course, was in the news just yesterday was the coordinated expulsion of a significant number. I think the number is pretty close to 100 Russian...
Over 100 now, yeah.
Diplomats from NATO countries as well as... As well as Australia.
And Ireland, as of this morning.
And Ireland. And I actually saw out of New Zealand, because New Zealand didn't expel anyone. And apparently New Zealand government said they looked and they couldn't find any undeclared intelligence officers in the diplomatic corps. So, but at any rate, the issue is now that a large number of Russians are going to be expelled. And of course, the expectation is that will provoke a classic Cold War style tit for tat in the sense that we will see a number of Western diplomats expelled. But I thought maybe it'd be useful just to walk people through the mechanics here, because there's of course the political dynamic, which is front and center in much of the coverage. And there's also the legal aspect. And the legal aspect is tied very closely to a concept most people will be familiar with. That is the concept of diplomatic immunity, or probably better described as diplomatic inviolability. And so I thought...
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah,
diplomatic inviolability.
Yeah, which immunity and viability are two concepts that are both deployed in the international treaty on this matter.
So is that the
Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations.
Right, okay.
Which codifies in term custom international law that goes back a long way. These are very old principles of public international law, because, of course, up until comparatively recently, if you wanted to engage in diplomatic practice, you had to send envoys. And so it was convenient to have rules of law that meant that your envoy wouldn't have their head chopped off as soon as they arrived in some foreign capital. So these are
less fun.
Yeah. So these are our old rules, and they are codified now in treaty. I think what's interesting about the Canadian announcement, which came out of Global Affairs Canada yesterday, they described, so there are actually seven individuals who are affected. There are four who are being expelled, and there are three that the government of Canada says they're unprepared to accredit. So these would be incoming people that will not be accredited as diplomats. And so the description here from Global Affairs: the four who are being expelled have been identified as intelligence officers or individuals who have used their diplomatic status to undermine Canada's security or interfere in our democracy. It's worth having a conversation about who these diplomats are, who are competent to engage or who do engage in intelligence or espionage activities. And there's this concept that you see in the press in this discussion about declared and undeclared intelligence officers, which is a more a political concept or a concept in diplomatic practice than truly in law. But basically, as I understand it, a declared intelligence officer is someone you know is a member of an intelligence service who performs largely a liaison role, right? And so we have declared intelligence officers in our embassies who work with their counterparts in the countries to which they're accredited. And so everyone knows their intelligence officer, and they perform as their function overseas the liaison role. An undeclared intelligence officer is someone who works for the intelligence service, but their official title suggests otherwise. And so,
they're a political officer,
right.
third
secretary for agricultural issues, right?
Cultural attaché.
Right. And so these are individuals who may, at some pro forma or part time basis, perform these actual official functions, but in the better part of their job are engaged in intelligence collection.
So can I, just to jump in here, I mean, the difference that we used to talk about is the differences between legal and illegal.
Yeah, although illegals, so here's the thing. Both declared and undeclared intelligence officers who are diplomats, they both enjoy diplomatic immunity or inviolability.
Yes.
An illegal is someone who's here without diplomatic cover.
Yes.
And so they are people who are here under false pretenses, and who do not enjoy any kind of diplomatic status.
Right.
And so they're actually in a completely different category, and you can actually get rid of them at the drop of a hat.
Oh, right? Yeah, that's not a problem. They are, yeah. I mean, the best example of this, and I'm sure people have heard this by now, an illegal would be the Americans TV show.
Right.
Right. That's a series of illegals, which is actually based off of people who first came to Canada to develop their legend
and then to go
to the U.S.
And we've talked about this case. It's currently the sons of the illegals who are the genesis for the Americans TV program have sought to retain their Canadian citizenship, and the Supreme Court has yet to decide whether it's going to allow leave in an appeal from the federal court, which said actually we had to give them their citizenship because of the structure of the Citizenship Act.
Exactly.
So we'll be looking forward to talk about that case if it does reach the Supreme Court.
Just to be clear, so what we're talking about here are
accredited
diplomats. So they are, but they're undeclared.
Yep.
But we would refer to them as legals.
Yes.
Because they have a legal status.
Right. So the issue is, how do you get rid of these people? If they're illegals, that is, they're not diplomats, they have no diplomatic status, then you can run them through your criminal law process if they engage in espionage. And you can remove them as foreign nationals through your immigration proceedings. And that actually was what security certificates under immigration law, before they became infamous in relation to trying to remove persons who were feared to be associated with terrorism. Security certificates were used to remove individuals who are essentially illegals, that is, intelligence officers here under false identities.
Mm-hmm.
But with diplomats, it's a bit different. So the starting premise for diplomats is that they enjoy this concept of inviolability. So the person of a diplomatic agent is inviolable. And so they're not liable to any form of arrest or detention. And so this is what we would call enforcement jurisdiction. in international law, you cannot enforce your laws against these diplomats because their persons are inviolable. Now, there's often a misunderstanding here. There's a sense that, well, the laws don't apply. And so all those people get parking tickets. Oh, we can't possibly get the, you know, recover the fines on these parking tickets because the laws don't apply to them.
It's a big issue in London, actually,
with
the Americans.
New York, and of course here it's been infamous in relation to drunk driving.
Right, of course.
So that's not true, actually. Laws of general application actually do apply to diplomats. They're not immunized from the application of rules of general application. So it's not like they can go about axe murdering people and expect that the laws of general application, in this case the criminal law, wouldn't apply to them. Same with rules of espionage. The difference is you can't enforce those laws because of this concept of inviolability. So they enjoy what's known as a immunity from enforcement jurisdiction.
Right.
And so that raises the issue is how you get rid of them. So first point, in international law, it is part of the function of a diplomatic representative to actually collect information. And the Vienna Convention that we talked about moments ago actually acknowledges that one of the purposes of a diplomatic mission is to collect information. So one of the things that they're supposed to collect is information on conditions and developments, which would include political, cultural, social, or economic activities in the country. And so there actually is a lot of information collected by diplomats.
Oh, sure.
But the standard is that they're supposed to conduct their activities in a manner that meets lawful means and conditions, right? And so it's supposed to be lawful means. They're supposed to use lawful means in the collection of this information.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be clandestine.
Well, yeah, it's a bit ambiguous, right? Because lawful means can mean different things in different countries. And so you can have countries where everything outside the capital is closed. And if you were, as a diplomat, to travel outside the capital, that would be a violation of the domestic law. And so would that be within the lawful means? Well, at some point, if you turn the clamp so tight, lawful means becomes so constrained that you can't actually perform one of the key functions of the diplomat, which is in fact to acquire some information on the host state, the state to which they're accredited. On the other hand, you can imagine another extreme where the law that's being violated is a fairly reasonable law. So you're from the diplomatic premises, you're intercepting private communications through some means that violates the law of the host country. That probably crosses the line and probably wouldn't constitute lawful means. But the bottom line is this concept of lawful means is quite murky. And so there's not actually any clear definition of it. So the bottom line is that states are free essentially to decide that a diplomat has transgressed the standard of lawful means, at which point they can't outright arrest the person for transgressing the standard of lawful means. Instead, they use this concept of persona non grata, PNG status, which is what is at issue in these recent acts yesterday.
I like to translate it as person no thank you.
Yeah, person no thank you. And there's not actually a good English translation for that. Persona non grata. It really just captures that.
Person no thank you. We should just call it that.
It's got kind of that sort of idea of excommunication, you know.
Right.
So persona non grata. And so what happens is once a state declares a diplomat persona non grata, and they're absolutely had the absolute discretion to do so. They're not constrained in their capacity to declare persons persona non grata. There's no legal standard. They have discretion to do so. Once they do that, then that person has to leave the country within a reasonable period. And if they don't leave the country within a reasonable period, then they lose their inviolability, which means that they then can be arrested. They lose that immunity. And so what happens in practice, of course, is once someone is declared persona non grata, they make haste and leave the country because there's no incentive for the sending state to allow their diplomats to be arrested. Now, what is within the contours of this reasonable period? It varies between states. And so I noticed that the Americans have given the diplomats their expelling 7 days. Our standard in Canada under what's known as the Foreign Missions and International Organizations Act is 10 days.
Okay.
So the person declared persona non grata has 10 days to leave the country, and if they don't leave the country within 10 days, they are no longer entitled to diplomatic immunity. The person is no longer inviolable. You can exercise enforcement jurisdiction over them.
Well, they better pay their Rogers bill because I'm not sure Rogers respects the Vienna Convention based on my experiences with
them.
Well,
that's a completely other issue as to whether you could ever enforce Rogers' contractual rules in Russia. So,
but I have a question for you, just based off of what you said about gathering information earlier, which is there was a very famous case in 1966. It was George Victor Spencer, who was, I was a low-level postal worker. He was, I think he was actually... He ended up like suffering from cancer, but he was basically arrested by the RCMP for passing along what ended up being open source information to the basically Soviet spies in Canada out in BC. And I think there was like kind of a fuss that was made about all of this because, frankly, he, you know, it seemed that the information that he was passing on was, again, you could just go to the library and get it. Mm. But people have pointed out that, you know, the information he was getting was actually could have been useful in developing illegals, mm-hmm. which we had just talked about. So, you know, I mean, that would, to me, would be an example of the collection of information in such a way.
It's a lawful means?
It's lawful means, but it could be put towards a...
Yeah. Like I say, the state has the discretion to define the scope of lawful means. Right. And so you can imagine circumstances where many states would conclude that it's excessive for a state to conclude the diplomat's functions is unlawful. That is, you know, you can only stay within this designated zone within the capital, and if you have any contact with any private citizen or travel, then that's unlawful. So a closed state, an autarkic state, which is essentially what happened in Russia in the 1960s and 70s. I just finished reading the memoir of a Canadian diplomat in Russia, and also was posted to Cuba, amongst other places.
Oh, I'm reading that.
Bill Warden's book?
Yeah.
It's actually really interesting.
Is it okay? Good. Yeah. I have picked it up, yeah.
So it's called Diplomat, Dissident, Spook.
Yeah.
And it's basically privately published memoirs. And it's sort of interesting insight into the way that external affairs then operated in the 1960s through the 1980s. So he operated in an environment in the Soviet Union, which was very, very closed, and he wasn't allowed to have any contact. So that's one example of where you might say, oh, really, is that too constraining on the functions of a diplomat? And at the end of the day, there's not much you can do to challenge that. But on the other extreme would be an example where everyone would probably agree that it exceeds the remit of a diplomat, which would be to tap into a phone call, for instance.
Yeah.
And so there, I think...
Or run a network of illegals.
Right, yeah. So like I say, there's not a bright line here, which is why the persona non grata status is entirely within the discretion of the state. And the constraint, ultimately, on states using persona non grata, even in circumstances where they may know that a given diplomat is actually an undeclared intelligence officer, the constraint really is the diplomatic fallout and the risk of a tit-for-tat use of persona
non
grata.
But this is what's so interesting about this, and that, you know, I've seen, well, like, I guess there's two points that I've been discussing on various media outlets and shows and on Twitter. The first is really that, you know, traditionally during the Cold War, we saw lots of these tit-for-tat exchanges, right? Like, it was very, very common. Mm. And, you know, they're not very effective because in the sense that you get rid of these guys, they're the guys you've been following for the last 2-3 years or whatever, and then they're just going to send over new people. Right. And then the whole process starts all over again, except you have to figure out who these people are and what they're doing and how they're there. So that's the first thing. But the fact is, on this scale, to replace 100 intelligence officers across the West at once, that's hard.
Yeah.
You know, like, and to reestablish all those activities. So I don't think this is going to end Russian intelligence. I don't think anyone's claiming it's going to. But the fact is, I think this is a proper disruption to those activities. Yeah. And that's something that means a lot to the Kremlin. So I think that's actually a really good thing, aside from the kind of very bold diplomatic stance that's there in the first place. And the second thing, the question I've been getting really is, like, well, why are we allowing these people here if we know they were engaged in these activities? And it's really just for the same reason. It's like, you know, it's better the devil you know than the devil you don't. If you've identified these people, you can kind of follow them around and figure out what they're doing, and they know they're being followed, so they're using tradecraft to try and evade that. So you know, I think Reg Whitaker, whose book with his you know, several colleagues, the Secret Service, he refers to it as the coyote and roadrunner, right. Escapades around Ottawa, and it, in some ways it is that, you know, that they are actually chasing each other around trying to figure out what they're doing. So that's one of the reasons, you know, that they're allowed to stay here. And the fact is, if we got rid of them every time we discovered a spy, you know, our diplomatic personnel would pay the price in Moscow.
Well, that's the other issue, right? So if there's if you say that there are 4 undeclared intelligence officers working in the Russian embassy in Ottawa, I don't know that we've got 4 undeclared intelligence officers working in the Canadian embassy, but I would suspect that what we're going to see is a tit for tat, and so 4 diplomats will be expelled from the Canadian embassy in Russia, and those may be actually bona fide positions within the embassy architecture, and so all of a sudden you degrade your capacity within the Canadian embassy to conduct the necessary functions of the Canadian embassy overseas, right? So the risk is, I mean, it's one thing, you get rid of the Russian intelligence officers, assuming you're right that they're intelligence officers, but on a proportional tit-for-tat basis, you might actually undermine your capacity to perform your diplomatic functions overseas.
Exactly.
So these are the kind of things that would probably be part of the balance in terms of analyzing the response to events like we've seen in Salisbury.
But in the course of, like, kind of writing about, you know, I've been writing about espionage for a book I'm hoping to put out soon. And there was an interview with a former Soviet spy. He was a spy here in Canada. And he estimated that during the Cold War, so between the 1960s and 1980s, 30 to 40% of diplomatic staff accredited to Ottawa, so accredited, were actually with the intelligence services in Russia, which is really interesting. But he said that a lot of those individuals were actually just there to keep an eye on the others.
Right.
So right.
The driver who's keeping an eye on the person driving. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's hard to know exactly how many of these individuals are intelligence officers in the Russian embassy here right now. Right. But, you know, again, like there is a disruptive element there. And I think, like I said, it's easy enough to replace four individuals when you have, just to focus on those four. But again, across so many different countries, to have to replace and reestablish, your intelligence activities is going to be substantial. And I think that's important.
Hmm. All right. Should we move on to the other thing that's been in the news quite a bit, the Cambridge Analytica story? Which most of our listeners are probably aware of, but just a basic primer here. And so the Globe and Mail had an excellent explainer on Cambridge Analytica and the unfolding scandal involving its activities in relation to Facebook. And so just to summarize here, so Cambridge Analytica is a firm that formed a partnership with an academic from Cambridge back in 2013.
A Russian academic.
Yes, although, again, based at a British university. And this academic developed a Facebook app for research purposes, in which something like 270,000 people downloaded and participated in this survey, essentially, that was part of this app. But under the app's licensing agreement, not only did they give over personal information from their account, but also the app was capable of extracting information from Facebook friends with low privacy settings. And so there was a pretty substantial amount of information that was scraped by this app. Now, the app was flipped and the data was flipped over to Cambridge Analytica. Well, at least it's purported to have been flipped over and some related firms. The facts are a little bit murky here. And then the story goes that the data was used to target specific voters in relation to the 2016 election in the United States. And then there's now conversations about the extent to which this data was manipulated and used for the Brexit campaign and the like.
Yeah, right. And it's important because, like, it's one of these things. So the technique that they developed was called psychometrics. And it's basically was used to kind of, it combined your likes and your interests. And then it also looked, at your other data. And it tried to figure out, like, what, your personality was and what your fears were and these kinds of things. And it used that to target you, which, is not great. But we don't have good information as to whether or not it actually was effective. I think this is the key thing that we have to keep remembering. There's no evidence. This is why we can say that the Russians tried to influence the outcome of the elections, but we can't actually definitively say if they succeeded. But I think what one of the concerns going forward is, and it's a little off our normal beat here, but these companies are going to get better at what they do. Right. Like, they're going to keep testing and they're going to keep working on it. This is just the beginning, unless there's some kind of laws that are put in place.
Right. Well, and there's certainly a lot of discussion about this to the extent that the discourse about developments in politics these days amount to, Facebook made me do it. so this comes back to the resilience question. Right. And so if you watch enough YouTube videos, pretty soon, it's like you're about three or four YouTube videos away from any kind of major conspiracy theory because of the recommendations they make. Right.
It's so bad.
If you look on Round Earth, within 3 videos, you find, conspiracies about a flat Earth. So
the algorithm
but
is nuts.
You have to be able to process this information. And so there's this issue about how we digest and process information as human beings and the extent to which we can build resilience in terms of being able to distinguish between the plausible and the implausible. But you raise this issue of law. And so one of the questions is, well, what about Facebook? So Facebook's rules at the time allowed researchers like this Cambridge academic to use the app, but they didn't allow the data collected through these methods to be passed on to third parties, at least for commercial purposes. Now, Facebook apparently has said that it only learned about these this collection in 2015, and it insisted that the information be destroyed, and it believed that this information had been destroyed. I should note that Cambridge Analytica, for its part, said it had never actually collected the Facebook data itself, and it blamed the Cambridge academic. So there's a lot of facts here that are murky. I'm going to bring in my colleague Teresa Scazza now to talk a little bit about what we know at present about this case and some of the privacy law issues. So she's going to talk about the commercialization of data. So people sign up to these things and, well, look, it's free. Well, no, actually, it may be free from a monetary perspective, but there's a cost. and this cost has pernicious knock-on consequences. And she'll talk about a little bit that, and then some of the concerns from a Canadian perspective about our outdated privacy laws and difficulties in enforcing privacy laws, as well as this issue as to whether this was a breach of contract as between Facebook and this app supplier, or whether it was a data breach. And there's a legal reason why Facebook prefers to see this as a breach of contract and not a data breach. So Teresa will talk a little bit about the Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act, one of these lengthy and possible titles that we have in law, but which goes by the acronym of PIPEDA. And so I'm going to bring her in now. Teresa is the Canada Research Chair in Information Law here at the University of Ottawa.
So one of the things that interests me about the Cambridge Analytica scandal is something that also came up in another scandal that broke in the fall of 2016 now, the Geofidia scandal. And both of them involved social media companies that, and this is the stock and trade of social media companies, they collect vast amounts of data. And they find markets for that data. So in most cases, social media platforms will have will create the capacity for developers of apps, developers of other products, data analytics companies to access their data and to access it for a fee. And so you have you basically it's like the social media companies are data farms, and they are then selling their product to other users who are taking that data and using it for other purposes. Now, the social media companies, of course, have contracts and privacy policies with their users who are contributing this data, and the users are contributing to a certain number of secondary uses, and you've got the privacy policies at that level. The social media companies then have contracts with their developers, and in those contracts with the developers, those contracts will provide that the developers are not supposed to do with that data things that they've promised their users are not going to happen with the data. And so the developers are, you know, have these contracts and are supposed to behave in a certain way. What I'm interested in is what happens when they don't. And what I find interesting about the Cambridge Analytica scandal and the Geofidia scandal are that in each of those cases, the only reason we ever knew anything about this misuse of personal information was because in the case of Cambridge Analytica, there was a whistleblower who said, look what's happening, look what's going on. And in the case of Geofidia, the American Civil Liberties Union of California had spent a year and an awful lot of resources digging through public records. The Geofidia scandal involved the police using social media data, or data analytics companies selling to the police data analytics for predictive policing, and in particular in the Geofidia scandal, for being able to target, identify and target individuals who are protesting against the police killings of two African American men in the United States. It was being marketed as being useful for the police to be able to identify these people. So this is why it's a scandal. And the reason we knew about it was because the ACLU had done this background work and had actually uncovered some emails that were really problematic. And so the question is, how many other companies are taking this social media data that they pay for, which access to which for they pay for, and using it for improper purposes? And how do we have any kind of transparency or oversight or ability to moderate what happens between the social media company and their developers? There are these contracts in place. The contracts are very nice, and they say you won't do these things. But is there any monitoring? Is there any enforcement? Now, after the Cambridge Analytica scandal broke, Facebook was very concerned, and Facebook, you know, wanted to be assured that Cambridge Analytica had destroyed this data and it was a misuse of the data and all of these sorts of things. But where were they before? If there's no oversight and there's no interest for these companies to pester the people who are paying them large sums of money for access to their data, you know, it's much more convenient to just assume that everything's okay and let it go. And so this, I think, is one of the challenges, that you have this commercial relationship for which there's no transparency, no oversight, and no real way of knowing what's happening, and yet there's enormous potential for abuse of personal information.
That's really interesting. And then but there was also a legal aspect, right? So you raised in your blog this issue as to whether our law can accommodate this sort of challenge,
right?
And whether it's kept pace with time.
Yeah, well, and certainly in terms of transfers of data from one company to another, PIPEDA essentially just requires that there be a contract in place, which there is. Clearly, that's not enough in the case of this type of relationship where there's such high risk in terms of the processing, and there are so many of these contracts. This is not just a company that needs to have its data processed so that, you know, for its own internal purposes. This is something on a different scale altogether. So it may be that we need more stringent obligations to ensure that privacy is protected where you have these downstream relationships about data. The other thing about our law is, of course, it has... enforcement is incredibly weak under the law. You can complain to the Privacy Commissioner and the Privacy Commissioner can investigate, but the decisions of the Privacy Commissioner are not decisions in any sense. They're not binding. They're recommendations, and they can be followed or disregarded. There's also an avenue to go to federal court for an order. The reality, an order and damages. Now, the problem, there are a number of problems with that. One of them is if you're an ordinary individual and you've gotten your response from the Privacy Commissioner, the company hasn't complied, and you want to go to federal court for an order, you're going to have to pay those bills yourself. And so that's a very expensive proposition for individuals. The federal court, you can also seek damages in the federal court, but the federal court has been very stingy with damages calculated on an individual basis. So you're looking at essentially sacrificing your own financial well-being in order to do a public good if you're going to go to federal court. The reality is that most of the complainants who have gone to federal court under PIPEDA have been unrepresented. And I think the decisions show that they have been unrepresented, and the damage awards show that they've been unrepresented. And so we've got this, you know, body of case law now where the damages are so small as to be meaningless, both for the individual who has to bear the burden of taking the matter to court and also to be any kind of deterrent effect. So the Privacy Commissioner needs the ability to do more in terms of enforcement and to have more power to compel companies to change their behavior. And as has been raised on many occasions, the power to impose fines. You know, the FTC in the United States can impose fines, and these fines are significant and can have a real deterrent effect. But in Canada, we don't have that power or ability. So we've got, you know, a nice privacy law, and we're often very proud of how our privacy laws are better than in the United States. But the privacy laws have very few teeth in Canada. And this, I think, is a very significant problem.
There's also a cross-border issue, too, in the sense that these things straddle international borders.
Well, that's right, yeah. And so the Privacy Commissioner has, you know, certainly taken steps in cases where Canadians' personal information has been misused by companies in other countries, finding the necessary connection to Canada and then take proceedings. I think the most recent one was the Globe 24 Hours one. I don't know if you remember that, where a Romanian website was scraping Canadian court cases and tribunal decisions and then posting them online in an indexed format. They're not supposed to be indexed in Canada so that individuals' privacy is protected. You can't, you know, you can't Google someone's name and get all the gory details of their employment insurance tribunal decision or whatever it happens to be. But the Romanian site was posting indexable court decisions and then charging people money if they wanted to have their personal information removed from the decision. So the Privacy Commissioner did take that on. It went to federal court for an order. And, you know, that's nice as far as it goes. There's no power to enforce. And I think we were all, you know, reassured by the fact that the Romanian data protection commissioners were also investigating the same company, and so that there was likely to be some action happening in Romania independently. But there are these challenges cross-border, whether anything has been done. In other cases that where the commissioner has been involved, for example, involving companies in the United States, in some cases the FTC has also been involved. And so you've got backup essentially in the other country. But without that, it's going to depend on the company's willingness to do something based on recommendations that wouldn't be binding even if they were in Canada.
Right. And then there's one other thing that came up in your blog, and that was the issue that this was data used as intended. It wasn't a data breach. So can you explain what you mean by, what would the implications be if this was a data breach? And also you raised the issue that the PIPEDA provision on mandatory reporting wasn't enforced, which seems, it's been a long time.
It's been a long time. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting, the way Facebook was trying to characterize this as not a data breach. And I think they're probably trying to do that for purposes of liability, because if they are the victim of a company, they had a contract in place with this company, and the company breached their contract, and as soon as Facebook became aware of it, and there's a lot of discussion about how soon Facebook was aware of it, but anyway, they tried to put a stop to it, then that's a different liability picture from Facebook having custody of all of this consumer information and allowing it to escape out of their hands. And so I think by trying to characterize it as not a breach, but not a data breach, but a breach of contract by another company, Facebook is trying to shape how this is perceived by the regulator or by privacy commissioners and so on. Whereas if it's a data breach, then it's something for which they are responsible and they have to show that they had the proper security in place to protect the information. So it is interesting to think about how it's characterized. Now, in Canada, we've been waiting a long time. I guess the amendments to the Act were in 2015. To add data security breach notification requirements in PIPEDA, which would mean that if there was a data breach, presented a real risk of serious harm to an individual, then the company would have to report that breach to the commissioner and might have to also report to individuals and provide notification to individuals of the breach. And so that's, that's fairly significant. We're still waiting for these to take effect because we're waiting for regulations, and it's taking an awful long time. And so I think that's one of the problems here, is that it's just, things move glacially slowly when it comes to getting tougher on companies with respect to how they manage personal information in Canada. And so that's, I think that's something that people should be aware of and concerned about. The other thing I think is interesting in the data security breach notification requirements that I mentioned in my blog is that they talk about the real risk of significant harm to an individual. And I think that's partly because we still have this mindset, and it's reflected, it's in every part of the legislation, it's in this consent-based model, the idea that the individual gives consent to the use of their personal information and has control, and it's all focused on the individual. And it really, I think it's a neoliberal vision of privacy as being something that each individual is responsible for their own privacy, and if they don't read the privacy policies or agree to things without checking, then they have to accept the consequences. And it really turns around the individual, and when people don't read privacy policies, then other corporations get to say, well, people don't really care about privacy. And so, again, it all comes back to the individual's responsibility to manage their privacy. And then we include these data breach notification requirements that focus on real risk of significant harm to the individual. But what Cambridge Analytica shows is, I think very clearly, is that privacy is not just about harm to the individual, it's about societal harm, it's about harm to the public good. And I think more and more that's becoming the case. And so we have data protection laws that don't even acknowledge or recognize that there are very public harms that come from data breaches. And that it's not just about the individuals, and that maybe we should be thinking about a privacy framework that tries to deal with the really problematic behavior quite independently from whether I give consent or you give consent or anyone gives consent, that we have to address the public harms that come from data breaches.
Stephanie, I think it might be useful for us to pick up from Teresa's comment and talk about this issue from the optic of national security, which is really our beat in this area. And I really thought that one of the interesting aspects, soon after the Cambridge Analytica issue broke in the news, there was some buzz. I saw some tweets from Citizens Lab and elsewhere saying, well, this is all well and good, but note that under C-59, because of the concept of publicly available information and the sort of open nature of the capacity that CSE and CSIS will have to collect publicly available information, that this is the sort of information that will be in play for these security services. I think that's worth a bit of a conversation here. We haven't spent that much time talking about the carve-outs that are available under the complicated oversight and checks and balances regimes that we've talked about in the past on this podcast for publicly available information. So the So for a lot of people, when they hear publicly available information, they think, well, the telephone book, to the extent it exists. Well, surely CSE and CSIS should be able to ingest that sort of information. So it really, everything depends on what you mean by publicly available information. And one of the debates to this point has been, well, what about hacked information? Information that was illegally obtained through a hack and then put in circulation. Is that now publicly available? And so at issue in some of the dispute over the scope of this concept of publicly available in C59, I will say that both the representatives of both the CSE and CSIS were quite emphatic in recent parliamentary testimony to say, look, hacked information is not would not be considered publicly available. If it were the sort of thing that, say, the CSIS needed to have, it would have to be processed through the checks and balances system for, say, Canadian origin data sets. And so we wouldn't use publicly available as an end run. This is different, though, right? This isn't a hack. What we're talking about with Cambridge Analytica is not a hack. It's a commercially bundled product. And so at issue is, if you can get a commercially bundled product that's scraped from social media data and packaged together and sold to the highest bidder, is that information that would fall within the envelope of publicly available information that can be ingested by CSE and CSIS without the same scope of checks and balances that would otherwise be applicable? And I think that's a novel question. Certainly the view on the part of Citizens Lab and the Canada Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic here at the University of Ottawa is that this is a real issue. And I think on the text of the law, it could be a real issue. And so I suppose the issue is, do we want to tighten that definition in the law so that this sort of practice would be policed by the stricter checks and balances regimes that are in place for other forms of information that aren't considered publicly available? My inclination is to say yes, if only to avoid the prospect of a new generation of controversies, including controversies that may be overstated, because your law is too open textured and rather you're depending on undertakings by the service that they wouldn't act in such a manner.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things here. First is, like, I think we need to differentiate social media, the way social media is used by intelligent services. In the first instance, you know, we've talked about cases. We talked about the one out in BC where, you know, the RCMP tried to prosecute someone based on their Facebook page. So we know that, you know, the security services here in Canada, they use social media when they look at individuals. Right. So, you know, let's say you're aware of someone is possibly engaged in activities. You can open up a low level investigation on them and that will start let you search them on Facebook and things like that. If you want to actually then really hack into their lives, you need an actual warrant if you're doing it at the individual. What this is not that. This is something totally different where you would be ingesting a
bulk data.
Collection. Right. Yeah. A bulk collection of information about people. I'm going to be dead honest with you, and I know I'm going to be the bad guy here, and I'm okay with that. I just don't see how this would be useful.
Yeah.
You're not importing, like, you would have to, I mean, so to get back to the psychometrics thing, you could then research, refine the data, and find people with extremist views. But the problem is, people with extremist views, there's thousands of them, millions of them potentially, not millions, but maybe hundreds of thousands of people with very extremist views, whether it's your kind of crazy uncle or whether it's, you know, someone who's maybe taking their religion a little too seriously these days. But that doesn't mean they're violent, right? So what this national security nexus always comes up when someone is violent.
Yeah, but you're looking at it from an anti-terrorism perspective, right? Where violence is the linchpin. Of course, the service and CSE have a mandate that's broader than simply intelligence collection for purposes of detecting people who are violent, including foreign influenced activity.
Yeah.
Right. And in relation to CSE, foreign intelligence or cybersecurity and its present mandate. And so the issue really, I agree with you. Look, I'm not sure that the building haystacks in this matter will prove from an investigative purpose.
I just don't see what it would be useful for.
Well, but the thing is, technology is moving at such a pace that this law has got to have a shelf life that endures through the next generation of you know, Web 3.0, whatever it's going to be.
I'm not objecting. I'm not, like, and when I, but like, let me just say this. When I object, like, I'm not objecting to tightening the law. Per se. I understand. I see what Citizen Lab's saying. I see what you're saying. I just, like, the first inclination, every time a technological capability is out there, the assumption is, oh my God, the security services have it and they're using it in the worst possible way. And maybe as a lawyer or an NGO, that's the assumption you have to make. But, you know, to be honest, I mean, you don't want, the last thing you want to do as an intelligence analyst or an officer or whatever is sift through thousands of profiles to try and figure out who might be a terrorist. I mean, it's just not a very efficient manner.
Well, okay, but that might not be efficient now. But again, if we're talking about artificial intelligence and big data and the like, all of a sudden the pieces of the mosaic become much more accessible for your analysis. And that's what the data set regime under the CSIS Act is really designed to enable, which is the capacity to ingest and then, subject to federal court approval, to preserve and to query information that's drawn from data sets that could be vast in scope. And so the issue is really whether the very careful, and we've made this point before in this podcast, I think the checks and balances for the Canadian origin data sets and to a degree data sets that involve foreign information, those are good checks and balances. The issue is that publicly available information is carved off from at least the same degree of rigor that's associated with these checks and balances. And so the question is that get out of jail free card or that exemption, is it overbroad such that it would have the effect of undermining the virtue of the checks and balances because it can be used to do an end run around them? Now, again, I don't think that would be in the service's interest, and I'm not sure that they would be inclined to do so. My fear is that we need to have a system that's sufficiently robust that it creates some degree of public confidence that the service, whose activities we will not necessarily be able to see in real time and certainly will be dependent on review bodies that will have only a partial auditing function and can't look at every activity the service engages in, that the services are actually meeting standards and expectations. And so why not embed into the statute a more meaningful definition of publicly available that has the effect of steering the sort of information we're talking about here, Cambridge Analytica style scraping of information, into the checks and balances system, which I think would have the effect. I don't think if there is an intelligence virtue to this sort of information, I don't think it would degrade it at all to put it through the regular system as opposed to running the risk that it's considered publicly available and thus is you can use it in a more open textured way.
How would you write that up?
Well, I mean, I think that's, so the devil's in the details on that. I think, so let's put it this way. The CSE Act, in terms of its definition of publicly available, is actually more robust than the CSIS Act. So in the CSE Act,
So far, right. So far in C-59. This could change.
So there's actually a definition of publicly available in the CSE Act. Now, some people would say, including Citizens Lab, that it's not sufficiently robust, and they would emphatically exclude, for example, hacked information. I might include information acquired through breach of contract, which is what's alleged in relation to Cambridge Analytica. In the CSIS Act, the definition of publicly available is basically a data set that was publicly available at the time of collection.
That's a difference.
Yeah, right.
But we don't know why that's different.
Well, I don't personally. And so could you not provide a little bit more rigor in terms of that definition? And I would say also that if you wanted to look for a template for this, our Personal Information Protection Electronics Documents Act, PIPEDA, which was discussed by Teresa Scazza. The PIPEDA has, in its regulations, has a fairly refined definition of publicly available information, which is fairly intuitive. It's, you know, information that was in public registries and telephone books and in open source publications to which you participated by doing a media interview and that sort of stuff. Now, I would add that the Standing Committee on Ethics at Parliament has proposed including social media data in this definition, and that's raised some ire because it, again, it's opening the door to the sort of thing we're seeing with Cambridge Analytica. But in other words, it's within our means to come up with a more meaningful definition of publicly available. Again, it's not to say the services shouldn't have this information. It's just that if you're going to get this information, it should be steered through the system with the most checks and balances.
And there needs oversight.
Yeah.
There needs to be oversight. And I don't object to that. I'm just always kind of like, just so long as you're using judgment, and so long as, you know, and we have to assume, I think, a little bit of good faith here.
And to be fair, even for publicly available information, once you get to the point where you want to query it under the CSIS dataset regime, you're only supposed to query and exploit that dataset and keep results in keeping with the CSIS mandate. And so, for example, if you're conducting security intelligence, you're only supposed to query in circumstances where strictly necessary in relation to a threat to the security of Canada. So it's not open season, in other words, and keeping these massive databases and querying them without some culling process that's part of the retention regime.
Canada. Yeah, so you know what, like, I don't object to any of that. I think you're right. Like, we have to make sure that this stands the test of time, because God knows when we're going to get another bill like this or some major changes like this. But it's interesting that you've it is an interesting issue. I see why people are concerned, especially now. But I don't want people to freak out right away.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a happy note to end on. Okay, we rarely end on happy notes. But all right, so that's all the time we have for today. And we'll end on that note. And we'll be back later in the week for our doubleheader on investment, trade, and national security, much also in the news.
See you next time.